Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Blended. Today, we're talking on a topic that is hugely important to conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, a topic that weaves into every conversation that we have in one way or another. And that's allyship. When underrepresented voices talk about their experiences and the challenges they face, they often talk about the importance of allies, whether that's supporting someone's career progression at work, standing up for somebody's rights, or elevating voices on a podcast like this one. But unfortunately, allyship isn't as simple as just lifting others up. It involves cost, sacrifice, and confronting privilege. And there could be suspicion, mistrust, resentment. And of course, we've all seen the huge gap between what people say on social media and what they do in reality. When it comes to allyship, there are no easy answers, and yet it really is key to creating a more equitable world. So I'm joined by Rokita, Mickey, Sharon, Weston, and Dylan, who are going to share their thoughts with us today and discuss what it really means to be an ally and help us figure out how we can make a real impact. So I'm so excited for all of you to join me. Let's get started with some introductions. So can each of you tell me who you are, what you do, and how you identify? Starting with you, Rokita. That's my fault, everybody listening.
Rokita Coleman-Williams. I'm vice president of intermodal sales and operations for Coyote Logistics, a UPS company, and I identify as she, her.
I love that. Now, you were one of the reasons why I decided to take on this topic. Because we were talking at one of the conferences last fall, and we were talking about how you are passionate about this topic, the real cost of allyship. Do you want to give people just a quick glimpse into why that's so important for you?
Absolutely. I've had a 27-year career, a very rich career in the logistics space. And along that journey, my understanding of allyship, my understanding of what it requires to be an effective ally has been challenged along the way, especially at the moment where I incurred enough political currency within my organization where I was no longer responsible for being the recipient of allyship, but now responsible as a leader in this organization to be an ally. And understanding the actual cost of that is beyond the words. To be an ally means involving actively supporting and advocating for the rights and inclusion of marginalized people. But it's not just a label. It's a continuous process of building those relationships. It's based on trust and consistency and accountability. Yeah. And not often do we talk about or unpack the really tough part. We talk about the responsibility of it, but oftentimes we don't really dig into what it might cost in order to step up and take that personal and professional risk.
Yeah. Being and we are going to do that today. So I appreciate you bringing this topic forth to me. Now, Weston, you just joined us. We're just going around the table to do some introductions. So I will start with everybody and end with you. And then we're going to get into the discussion. So Sharon, I am going to go to you next. Can you tell everybody who you are, what you do, and how you identify?
Yeah, I'm Sharon Sire. I'm a mom and a grandmother. I'm a manager, a leader. I'm a philanthropist. I'm everything. I've been in the logistics industry for nearly 40 years now. So I started back when there were very few women in the logistics industry before the term logistics was even invented. So I have been through a lot of issues with women in the industry, getting the name they deserve, the positions they deserve, the money they deserve. So I've always been an advocate of the allyship, even though I didn't realize that was the term at the time. Yeah. And so that's my goal now towards the end of my career is giving back and helping others not have to go through what I went through. I can teach them through my experience and hopefully they can learn from that.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for being here. Dylan, I'm going to go to you next. Can you tell us who you are and what you do and how you identify?
Yes. Well, pleasure. Thank you for having me on. So my name is Dylan M. Rafferty. I'm currently the founder, president, and chairman of the North Texas Disability Chamber, for a community organization serving and advocating for for and on behalf of people with disabilities. I am a Caucasian male, and my pronouns are he and him. On my spare time, I love joining different clubs as well as dancing to different sporting events. So just a little humor for those that are listening. But thank you.
And it's the Mavericks, right? That's yep. Where you've got Jumbotron famous.
Yes, exactly. Several times.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for being here. Mickey, you're up next. Can you tell us who you are, what you do, and how you identify?
Hi, I'm Mickey Diaz. I identify as she, her. I'm Chief Operating Officer here at Unique Logistics. I've been in the logistics industry for about 33 years. I started in the warehouse. I am 4'11" Latin woman. So if you can imagine that in the warehouse in the 80s, I can tell you that allyship has been very important in my life and my career. And I look forward always and I'm very conscious of giving that back to others. So very interesting topic and very near and dear to my heart.
Awesome. Super excited for you to be here. Thank you so much. And last but not least, Weston, tell us who you are, what you do, and how you identify.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. And sorry, I was a little bit late. I chaired my first meeting of the Workforce Commission for the City of Long Beach, and our closed session ran a little long today. So, but I'm glad to be here. I'm Weston Labar. I identify as Ginger. But no, more importantly, I'm a he, him man. So I am a logistician and a trucker through and through. I've been in this industry a little over a decade now. I currently work for a company called Cargomatic as their chief spokesperson and handling a variety of things, including industry relations. And prior to joining, wore a lot of different hats, but the one probably most people know me for was as the CEO of the Harbor Trucking Association for 7 years, helping really be the voice and be the representative of the nation's drayage industry and the variety of carriers moving America's goods in and out of our seaports.
Awesome. Well, super excited that you could be here. We're only just getting started, so you're not really that late. And let's get started with the conversation. Let's set the scene. So what is allyship? Now, Raquita, you started us off in your introduction. You are the inspiration for this episode. So talk to us about what allyship means to you, and then we're going to go around and get everybody's perspective on this.
Yeah, allyship is the opportunity that one takes to actively support advocate for the rights and inclusion of marginalized and underrepresented groups. It's an opportunity to drive social change by leveraging privilege for equity and bringing attention to injustices and challenging systemic oppression.
Thank you for sharing that. Dylan, what do you think?
You know, one of the things that I look at allyship is several things. You know, as somebody with disabilities and the communities that I seek out to serve and represent, you know, sometimes allyship is seeing the inequities and then speaking up, not standing by, but more so in speaking up. You know, my friend Sint Marshall, the CEO of the Dallas Mavericks, often says, "Show up and show out." And as allies, we've got to show up and we've got to show out. And that's what I think of allyship, is really showing up and being there and being present in the moment.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Weston, what do you think allyship means to you?
Yeah, you know, I come from a place that, believe it or not, pretty homogenous in Pennsylvania. And so I joked earlier about identifying as ginger, but growing up, I felt like I was the diverse person just because I looked different from people that I was in class with. And now living in Southern California and spending 10 plus years in Long Beach, which is one of the most diverse cities in the entire nation, to me, I've gotten a really good opportunity to understand what allyship means, both in the sense of being part of a very homogenous group of people, that the diversity may be very small, to a melting pot of people who are advocating for equal opportunity. And when we talk about DEI, it's that equity and inclusion part that I think are so important, because it's about giving diverse people the opportunity to all be part of the ability to help create and manifest what the roadmaps of our communities look like. And so for me, I've taken it very personally to use the privileges that I've been given as a white male in society to try to be an advocate for those who maybe in some cases don't even realize how special or how powerful their group could be. And an example of that is I've been the chairman of the board of the United Cambodian Community in Long Beach for 10 years. And I got engaged in that community because I saw you have over 50,000 Cambodians living in Long Beach. It's the largest population of Cambodians outside of Cambodia. They were displaced because of horrific genocide and terrible cultural experiences that they went through in their home country. And so many first generation folks didn't even feel comfortable advocating for their own needs here in the U.S. because of their aversion to government. And so I felt like getting engaged with that community as an example and being able to help not just create conduits with City Hall to help make them feel more comfortable in their own city, to talk about what the priorities of a community that makes up, you know, more than 10% of the population in Long Beach, was not just something that I embraced doing, but I felt like it was my duty as somebody coming into the city and having access to those opportunities. And over the last 10 years, I've gotten to see what it's like being a vocal ally and then taking a step back and being a supportive ally and giving other people the opportunity to now represent themselves and feel comfortable. Now we have the first elected Cambodian on city council. We have several thriving nonprofits. We're engaging in things like job creation, workforce right. training, economic development. And I bring these things up because it really starts with showing people that come from diverse backgrounds how important they are to the fabric of the communities that they're in, and showing them the power of their voice in some ways and shapes and situations that they didn't even realize that they had.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you're,
that's what I think is important.
Well, and you're pulling hands up, right? Yeah. You're reaching down and pulling hands up, which I think is important. And is it okay if I talk about one of the reasons why you're on this episode?
Sure.
So you did talk about being a white male and privilege, but you also have ADHD.
Amongst others, yes.
And it's one of the reasons why you and I talked about you being part of this episode, is because that is something that you've always had to either be an ally for yourself or be an ally for others within business who do have ADHD as well.
Yeah. So, you know, and I'm happy to share. I mean, I was diagnosed with ADHD as a 4-year-old, right? I've gone through the entire gamut of taking medication as a child to deciding in my teenage years I no longer wanted to working with cognitive behavioral therapists on non-medication forms of trying to overcome some of the roadblocks that come with ADHD. But also, you know, I was diagnosed with MS when I was 24 years old, and I've been very fortunate that it has not it hasn't progressed, and I'm able to live and function as a normal human being in many instances. But I bring these things up because several years ago, I wouldn't have shared them. I actually felt like it was a disadvantage to open up to what some of my perceived weaknesses were.
Yeah.
And what I've come full circle on, especially, you know, COVID, if it did one great thing for a lot of people, it was the opportunity to reevaluate our lives once we got the chance to step away from the rat races and really understand what's important. And I feel like, again, you know, I am somebody who's been relatively successful and has been able to accomplish certain things despite having MS and ADHD. And I know there's so many people that go through hardships, whether it's diseases, whether it's mental health issues, anxiety, depression, et cetera. And I feel for those of us who can be inspirational to others, we need to take that opportunity and we need to lead by example.
Yeah.
We need to own that we all have adversity in life that we need to overcome.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, if somebody like myself's not willing to share how that's played a role in my life and the things I have overcome to get where I've gotten to today, how can I expect others to do the same thing? And at the same time, I think it actually is such an important part of the narrative of what makes people special, because we all have things that we overcome in life. And until we understand that everybody has their metaphorical baggage to get through and to deal with, you know, I feel like by understanding people and by being honest and open about who you are as a person, we can actually cut through the metaphorical BS that we all deal with every day and try to help each other be allies for whatever we all need allyship for.
And thank you so much for bringing that up. The reason why I brought that up is because as we go through and we talk about this topic of allyship, it can come up in a variety of different ways, right? And so I bring it up because I think that's an important point to note. So I appreciate that. Mickey, what do you think allyship means to you?
I think it's been very well explained. If I had to go back to my Brooklyn roots, I would equate it to, you know, standing up for someone who might be bullied or just making sure that the little voice is heard, that we're standing up and addressing biases and injustice or biases and things that are not really meant to hurt someone, but still do. Mm-hmm. And those are the biggest and hardest things. And I know you had a podcast on bias, but that's the hardest thing to get through, right? Mm-hmm. To get someone to acknowledge or to see that, you know, hey, we ought to have more color in our organization, or hey, we ought to have more women in our organization, because it's not necessarily done intentionally. It just happens. But then you have to be intentional in trying to bring inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. So allyship is really about being aware of what's going on and making sure that you're addressing it properly. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, people talk about using your privilege. The more privilege you have, the harder it gets to use it, because it's kind of opposite of what you're, I don't know, not supposed to be doing, but what is norm? What is the norm?
Yeah. And I appreciate you for sharing that. We're going to talk about, obviously, the cost of allyship. And one of those is mental health and exhaustion. Which I want to dive more into a little bit later, because if we keep asking the same people to advocate for themselves, it's just, you know, anyways, we'll get into that. Sharon, last but not least, I mean, you do a lot of work around human trafficking, you know, women in industry, that kind of thing. What has allyship, what has that definition, and has it changed, right? What did it start with? Has it changed? What does that look like for you?
It has changed because, for instance, when I started in the workforce, I didn't start out in logistics. I was an educator. Before I was an educator, I was going to school and I was working at a bank in the international department. But in every line of work, you still have the same issues. I was fortunate enough when I worked at the bank, I worked for a man who, and I was his secretary. Back then it was secretary, not admin. He was the executive vice president of the department, and this was in the 70s, and he loved hiring women. And when he hired me, he said, I will never take you to lunch. I will never ask you to bring me coffee. I will never ask you to go pick up my laundry. He goes, you have a job to do, and I will treat you like a professional. Hmm. And he said, and I expect you to treat the other people in the office as professionals as well. So he was more of a mentor to me, but he also hired a Black woman as a vice president, which was unheard of back in the 70s, another woman as a vice president over one of the departments. And so he gave me a lot of advice because he saw potential in me, for one thing. And he put me on committees. He gave me a lot of confidence, but the first thing he told me that I had to do if I wanted to work for him is I had to lose my Texas accent.
Oh.
Yeah, which was a big shocker because.
But he did everything right with that.
But we dealt with people around the world, and he said, you can't talk like that. You have to, and I did. I lost my Texas accent. I had to be very intentional about the way I spoke. But when I got a job as a teacher, it came back in 5 seconds, mm-hmm. you know. And so I can talk without it, but I can't think of what I want to say if I'm thinking about how I'm going to say it with my voice. So I don't like hearing myself on podcasts. I just hate it, but I'm trying to work on it. But then when I left there and I did the education thing and then went into logistics, I lost my voice somewhere because I found out very quickly it was a good old boys club. Mm-hmm. And women were not respected. Things like that. You couldn't
go really get coffee.
Go get coffee. Yeah, it was crazy. I actually applied for a job at an LTL company, and they told me they don't hire women because they felt like women cheated on their expense reports more than men did. And they could get by with saying that back in the early 80s. And wow. I thought, well, how do you know that? There aren't any women in sales.
Right.
You just don't want to hire me.
And for anybody listening to this that doesn't know what LTL means, it's less than truckload.
Less than truckload. Yeah. So I ended up becoming an agent working for myself. And then I eventually moved on to working for other companies. And I was able to, but I had to work really hard. And I had a customer one time call our office and say, do you have any women mm-hmm. salespeople in your office? And they said, yes, we have Sharon. And so I went over there and he said, the reason I asked for you is because I found that women have to work harder than men to, you know, for people to pay attention to them and to respect them. So mm-hmm. I always want a woman. You know, because you'll do more for me than any man ever will, as far as getting my freight delivered and getting me the service.
I don't know if that's advocacy or not, though.
I know, but it started giving me a little confidence. Okay. You know, where you weren't getting any, mm-hmm. and so then that started. But there's still very few women. We had a women's transportation club in Dallas. Mm-hmm. We had 10 women, and it didn't last long because they're just not enough of us.
This journey for you, you know, how have you ended up with like what the definition of allyship is for you?
Well, because I finally had some people, I have never worked for a woman in logistics mm-hmm. and I've never had a female boss, but I've had some men, not all men are bad. Not all men are in the good old boys club that have mentored me and pushed me up. Now, once I got up and we started hiring women and people of color, I became a big advocate of pulling them up with me because I understood what it was like. And so whenever I've been a manager of a department or a company or whatever, I've always hired more diverse people. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a big advocate of they've got to be qualified too. You know, I don't just hire them because of the color of their skin or that they're a female. I want to make sure they can do the job. But right. what I found is we need to do more to educate people so that they can get those positions. So I've been a proponent of doing training programs in companies that I've worked for and preparing people to move up in the company and get right. better jobs. But I've worked for large corporations, big 500 companies, where they didn't have any DEI. I mean, nothing.
Yeah. And we need more of that.
So it just depends on where you work. And so that just... it gave me the goal of I'm going to pull people up. Now, what's happened was I have people reaching down and pulling me up to help me. So I have a network of a lot of good friends now in the industry that if I don't feel confident enough to do something, they're out there saying, awesome. You can do this.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of allyship, right? Is really making sure that you've got people in your circle that are like, you can do this. Now, I just want to pause there for just a second. I have like golf ball size hail that's happening outside right now. So if my power goes out, we may have to reschedule this if I can't get it in. Just letting you know. Okay. So while you were talking, I was looking at this and I'm like, oh my goodness, something's going to come through my window. Anyways, let's keep this rolling. And hopefully we won't lose power. All right. So business consultant Jennifer Brown created what she called the allyship continuum, in which she described allyship in four phases: apathy, awareness, activity, and advocacy. And so, you know, the reason why I asked Sharon, you know, what has that journey looked like around advocacy and allyship for her is because I think the allyship is more of a journey, right? And I want to preface that by saying, you know, all of our careers are a journey. Everything is changing all the time. And so we're never necessarily going to be perfect at it. But we do need to be open to learning and understanding what those different levels of allyship can be. And so I think one of the ones that, and I'm not sure if Weston, you talked about this earlier, but I think something is, there's something called performative allyship. So now, Raquita, I want to bring you in for this one. Can you describe what that actually means? And, you know, whether it's good or maybe harmful to, you know, what we think or see allyship as being.
Absolutely. So performative allyship is the issue of allyship where the actions are more about a personal gain than actual support. Mm-hmm. And it is harmful. It is harmful. The reality of it is that in order to be, in order to meet allyship with integrity, the nature of it has to be founded in empathy. And the very antithesis of empathy is doing something or approaching something for one's own personal gain without context or concern for another party. Allyship is very complex. There is the complexity of the intersectionality of it. It is the complexity of how to be effective at it. It is the complexity of what does it look like as the ongoing nature and importance over time. But the reality of it is that we have to agree that it is most effective when it is founded and the foundation of it is around empathy.
Well, and I think, thank you for sharing that. I think the complexity of it really makes it so much harder than actually people maybe realize, right? And that's why we're talking about the real cost of it. And I'm glad that we talked about performative, right? Because at the end of the day, the people doing the work they want to make sure that those that are just doing it performative also don't have the opportunity to do that. And so we have to know what to recognize as well as good allies as to what is working for us and what is working against us as well. Dylan, do you have any examples of maybe performative allyship? What do you think about that? And how do we, you know, I know that you've gone through recently sort of the job hunting process, the interview process. And I think it's been very challenging for you. And I think that's a process that we need a little bit more allyship in. What do you think?
Yeah, I there's a lot of talking points here that I'm just picking it all in. You know, as a job seeker, you know, sometimes you have to, you have to be self-aware and sometimes self-advocate for yourself in a lot of areas. But when it comes to performative allyship, the way I look at it, I try to focus less on myself and then focus on others. I try to focus on how I can support them without necessarily intervene, just more like, for example, I did a training yesterday to the Texas Rangers baseball club, HR teams. And I told them that there's a common thing that I, denominator that people often talk about is ableism. And ableism is the idea of stepping in without necessarily, basically saying that, yeah, we're capable, we want to help you and so forth, rather than allowing that person to express it themselves first before you step in and so forth. And so it's kind of like, and part of all my relationships that I built, Sarah, is I focus on, how could I help them? And I think that is, as part of allyship, is better learning and understanding. And, you know, Weston, I currently am going to University of Southern California, although I'm in Texas, I'm getting my doctorate in organizational change and leadership. And I will say is I am also coming from a family of a privileged background. I live in an upper middle class neighborhood. My family is in the upper middle class as well. And while those privileges come in place, I always look at allyship of being self-aware of your current existing surroundings and then how that differs from those that are different from me. And most importantly, and one thing that I want to mention, Sarah and everybody, is that I don't like thinking about the negativity. Negativity brings the worst in people. And so especially me, it brings the worst in me. And I don't like negativity at all. But one thing that allyship needs to be focused on is how we can support one another and vice versa. And ultimately looking at the awareness piece. I mean, that is so key in allyship, is being self-aware, because if you just go at it head on without learning that there could be potential consequences from that. And then lastly, really one thing I always advocate for is advocacy and self-advocacy and so forth.
Yeah. And you make a really good point there, right? Not to assume that somebody wants your help.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because sometimes we think we're doing the right thing and we go ahead and we sort of push ourselves on somebody to help them.
Yep.
But you're right. We really need to also sometimes wait for somebody to actually say, no, I need your help. Can you help me do that? And that's a fine balance too, right? Because some people feel comfortable asking for help. Some people don't feel comfortable asking for help. And so I think as an ally and allyship that we're talking about today and kind of that cost of that is how do you sort of ride that fine line, right, Weston?
I would 100% agree. And as I was talking about before, even the role in which I was an ally of Long Beach's Cambodian community changed over time based on what the needs of the community were, because it wasn't about me, right? And I think that's where this all starts. It starts with understanding and intent, right? Because there are people that have intent, and while they may be doing good things, are they doing them for the right reasons? Because that will impact how they serve as an ally. And I say serve very intently, intentionally, I should say. And then understanding really what does the community you're being an ally of need? What are they trying to accomplish? What are the goals that they have set for themselves, and understanding how you can best help them achieve those goals to get to a point of, you know, equity or inclusion or overall community diversity, I think are extremely important. And you know, it's funny because when you talk about privilege, you know, Dylan brought up, you know, how he identifies the privilege that he was given, and it's interesting because again, growing up where I grew up, privilege was not something we discussed around the dinner table, if you will. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize I grew up in a single family household with my mom. We were too poor to live on our own. We lived with my grandparents. But the privilege that I had is how I look. But I grew up in a household that was filled with love and encouragement. And I know that that's a privilege that not everybody else gets. And so, you know, for me, I've always felt like anything is accomplishable if you put hard work and you put ambition behind it. And then I think that is so true with allyship. But again, you have to understand it through the guise of the people that you're trying to help. Otherwise, you could actually do more harm than good. Mm-hmm. And the last thing, because you brought up anxiety and depression a little bit earlier, I think one of the things that I've learned more than anything is that in order to help anybody in any situation, you first need to be on solid footing yourself. You need to be in a position to actually help people. And whether that is as an employer who is trying to create a different type of culture and more diversity within your workplace, or whether that's, you know, volunteering within the community, if you are also in a situation where you're seeking help, sometimes you first should attend to yourself before you can go and help other people, because mental health's a real thing. And a lot of the anxiety that people experience, especially in these types of situations, is because they're trying to do the right thing, but they haven't helped themselves enough to be able to actually help people the way they want. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to keep in mind. Are you in a position to actually help people in a way that they are asking for the help or not? And it's okay to say, I can't help you right now, but when I can, I'll come back. Because right. I think that far too often, you end up with people who feel like they have to, otherwise they're not doing their part. And in some cases, again, it's maybe not the right situation.
Yeah.
And I also feel like, you know, going to a very white collar university and then also moving to an affluent area like Southern California, there is an ivory tower approach that is very real. And in some cases, it's almost more offensive when folks are trying to help a community because they feel like they can't do it without their help. Like there's almost this feeling of I'm better than you, so you need my help, which I experienced a lot in New England when I went to college. But I think that I go back to the understanding what are you trying to accomplish and what is the communities you're trying to be an ally of asking for help and what are they trying to accomplish? And is your intent to actually help them or is it to position yourself to be in a better situation? These are important questions that everybody should ask themselves.
Yeah. Really, really great point. Now let's talk about the real cost of allyship. And we've kind of alluded to this throughout the conversation, but it's hard, right? It's not easy. There's a lot of nuance to this. There is a lot of ways that it can go right. There's a lot of ways that it can potentially go wrong. And I think it takes a little bit of sacrifice. Sharon, what do you think about that? Why is allyship hard? Why does it take some sacrifice? You know, why don't more people do it?
Well, in today's society with social media, people hide behind that, I think, a lot. And they're meaner. You know, I think people are afraid you're going to get canceled if you say the wrong thing and you mean it in a good way, but your wording might be misunderstood. You might get in trouble at work. You can't talk about certain things, or HR says, no, you can't do that. So you're always afraid. I think that's the cause of most of it is fear. Fear that if you try to help and it fails, it's going to come back on you and hurt you. But at some point in time, you got to just suck it up and say, hey, this is more important than what's going to happen to me.
Yeah, so, it's such a great point. I hear this all the time around pronouns.
Yes.
People are like, I just don't know. So I'm not going to do anything about it. And I'm just not going to address them or he or she or however they want to be addressed. And I see that a lot with that. And I think you're right. I think there is fear around that. And we'll talk about some solutions a little bit later. Mickey, what do you think about this? Why is it hard? Why do people have to sacrifice? If you have any examples of sacrifice in the name of allyship, share those as well. And then Rakita, I'm sure you have some to share. So we'll come to you after that.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about what is the cost, and I can talk about it personally and corporately.
Sure.
So from a personal standpoint, the cost of allyship is exclusion, right? The very opposite of what you're trying to, you want diversity, inclusion, but if you talk about it too much, you will be excluded because people don't want to have conversations around you because they think you're just that way. So exclusion, I think, is one of the costs. From a corporate standpoint, it's very risky for us or companies to put out what their beliefs are, because there's always going to be somebody on the other side, right? This is what being human is about. If we all thought the same, it'd be a pretty crazy world. So while we want people to treat everybody fairly and we want diversity and inclusion, et cetera, and I'll give you a big, you know, a good example, the Israel Hamas attack. Of course, as a company, we want to put out something that says this is horrible, what just happened. As a company, we have to also acknowledge that we have employees that might be Palestinian or that might side with that or that might have had family. So we have to be very careful about what we put out. We can't just say, hey, you know. So those are the type of things that always require more thought and really require you to have But that's exactly the reason why you want to have a diverse staff, if you will, because you'll have all the different opinions and you'll be able to put out something that is, you know, good and fair and you know, shows that you care, but you don't want to take a side. And it, from a corporate standpoint, it can get very difficult. Now, if I take off my corporate, I can be very, you know, this is right and this is wrong. But even that brings you some hardship in terms of your personal life, who will and will not sit and have a glass of wine with you.
Yeah. Well, we've seen, you know, we've seen broken up families just because of politics. We've seen, you know, people lose their job for acting a certain way, you know, whether right or wrong. You know, the black square, I believe, just from a couple of years ago, if you did it, if you didn't do it, there was, you know, reasons for both. And then, you know, even in that example that you shared, you know, you've got some celebrities who have stayed silent for too long that, and I'm using air quotes here, because who really determines what is too long and for somebody to gather their thoughts and really figure out what something means to them. So Raquita, what do you think about this? And if do you have any examples to share?
Yeah, so I have a really pointed point of view on this.
All right.
First off, you know, I do think that the cost of allyship is layered. So there is that personal, there's the personal professional risk of it. Think about, I mentored a young woman some years ago, and one of the challenges she was facing is she was a business leader. And in her organization, matters around inclusion and matters around how to build culture and be a culture leader were the responsibility of HR. And as a business professional, every year she would run into these situations where in her performance reviews, she was given feedback that she was meeting all expectations as a business leader. But there was always a question of, are you a business leader or are you an activist?
Wow.
So there was a penalty that she was experiencing in her career progression, because rather than being perceived as a leader, she was being perceived in the context of activism. And so her question to me was always, why can't I be both? If my male colleagues go out and they support the Animal Foundation, the Animal Rescue, or if they support St. Jude and they do walks and they put together events, they're seen as leaders, but I'm seen as the work that I do in my community to build an inclusive culture is seen as a potential distraction to the core work and responsibility that I have. So there's a real, that's that real risk. There's also the risks of emotional fatigue, because I find that a lot of times, and especially now in my circle, I co-chair the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Collective in my organization. And I find that a lot of the people who really dig into this work and who are really committed to it are also addicted to results. And gosh darn it, if you are addicted to results, there is no way to get more disappointed than to walk into a DEI meeting. Because the work is slow, it's continuous over time, the milestones continue to change. So there's that fatigue over, I'm investing real energy, I'm also investing real currency. So you think about privilege as dollars to be spent. So 20 years ago, I had $5. I didn't have a whole lot of agency. I didn't have a whole lot of professional power. Today, I probably have $100 in my pocket. And so every time I'm acting as an ally, I'm inevitably taking money out of my pocket and I'm spending it on behalf of another party. So at some point, you start to look at, am I getting a return on the investment? Am I seeing change? And when you're constantly spending that currency of privilege, but not seeing change, it absolutely wears you down. The reality of it is that it is not a destination. And so what we have to have is we have to have spaces where we actually acknowledge that all allyship, we just can't rely on altruism. We have to have spaces where we honestly say, hey, I've overspent and I'm exhausted. And this is costing more than I anticipated that it would. And that doesn't mean that I'm checked out, but that inevitability for those who really go hard for creating an inclusive culture, that's an inevitability for them. It's an inevitability.
Well, and creating that safe space around allyship to be able to have conversations and not feel like a failure or a bad person if I'm at that point to be able to talk about it. And so it's interesting what you're talking about, because we're talking about allyship to another party, like you said. But then there's the supportive network of allies, which you may or may not know you're sitting next to or how somebody else feels, because we don't talk about it enough. But it's a supportive network of allies that we have to build so that they can also get the support so we can drive change forward. Right? That's such a great point.
And we have to energize each other, and that starts with honesty. Some of my most effective allies have been people that at times I did not like, nor did I regard them as an ally. Mm. In fact, one of my allies in the last 5 years was someone who said I would never work for them again. Mm. Because I thought during the long career of the long time that I reported to them, I thought that, you know, they were just blowing smoke up my butt. I was like, I'm not getting promoted. I'm not getting advanced. The respect, I'm still earning credibility after 20 years. What is this individual really doing? And it helped me to see the limitations to even that individual's influence. I'm like, you're a tall white guy. You have power. Well, that's not always true. Like, and I started to understand that titles aren't equivalent to power. Titles also aren't equivalent to influence. So it took that individual departing the organization and recruiting me into another space where I had the opportunity to see the context of allyship change. Because there are limits to how effective you can be as an ally based on the context that you're in.
Man, I'm listening. I'm going to come to you in just a second, because that is such an amazing point. Is sometimes we don't recognize the limitations that our allies have and the expectations that we have of somebody just because we think they have it isn't necessarily true. So not only do allies have to check themselves, we also have to check ourselves when we're asking for help. Interesting point. Thank you so much. Weston.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to this that I think in any situation, and there's some things that are less politically charged and divisive than others, but in a lot of instances where people, I would say, have the fear of being an overt ally, it's because they believe there's a repercussion in some way, shape, or form for them doing that, right? And I believe that education throughout the process and continuously learning is so important, not just in the reference of how to best be an ally to different people or different groups of people, but also there's so many divisive topics. And most of these, unfortunately, have become political footballs that, you know, elected officials have felt maybe it's better they don't solve than they do solve. I'll leave that for maybe a different podcast. But there's a lot of people that can argue the one perspective that they believe in, but they can't actually understand or argue the alternative perspective. And I think to be a true ally, especially when you're trying to support something that maybe you are not directly or overtly impacted by, being able to understand all sides of the argument so you can also be a bridge and help educate other people and maybe help overcome some ignorance in these situations is super important. And you know, when you sit at the family Thanksgiving table, and I've got certain members that are on the blue side of the political equation and other ones that are on the red side, I'm the weirdo that likes to lob political footballs in there and then try to break them down to where there's commonality so they can actually start to have a real dialogue about these things. Because I feel like one of the biggest issues, I think this perpetuated by the media and by social media, is that people come up with some sort of opinion about divisive topics and they don't continue to grow or learn or mature. And a lot of what they say is devalued because of the ignorance of not understanding the other side of the argument. Whereas just sometimes acknowledgement that there's a different perspective breaks down the barriers enough to have a real dialogue around it. And this is it's not about just rapid change. This is an evolution. And to Rikita's point, like, it takes time, it takes energy, it takes effort. There's a lot of discouragement that can happen. But if you continuously try to learn and educate yourself and fill those knowledge gaps, and evolve as an individual, it gives you a better opportunity to help other people evolve in the way that they think and approach situations, which then makes them a better ally in any situation.
Yeah. Well, and I think you make a really good point. I mean, we have to learn to grow. And like I said at the beginning of this, we're not going to be perfect at it, right? We're not going to be perfect at it. Things are going to change. Opinions are going to change. Dialogue is going to change. And we have to be open to that. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, right? Change is not easy. Now, I want to go back to sort of the blame or judgment around not speaking out. So I was reading a story about a lady that was in a cab on the way to a conference. The driver was racist towards the Chinese community that they were driving through, and she said nothing. As a Black woman, she felt she should have, but she was running late, she was alone, and she was scared. And this really made me think about how difficult genuine allyship can be and why things aren't really always so black and white. Because in this case, if the woman had prioritized allyship, she could have maybe actually found herself in danger. And that is a true risk for underrepresented voices for also speaking out against underrepresented, you know, voices in a situation like that. So talk to me about, you know, a situation like this. What should have been done, what shouldn't have been done, and how do we stop blaming or judging not only ourselves, but other people for not speaking out? Sharon.
Okay, so one of the things I feel is happening is, that's been happening, is we're going a little bit backwards instead of forward. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because, I mean, I've lived in 7 decades, and I've seen it from Martin Luther King, I've seen it through the women's movement, and I've seen it up to now. And I see that we're losing some of the things we gained mm-hmm. by the fight that we went through because of social media, the difference in what people are going through right now. And so I think people are afraid. I mean, as a white-haired woman, older woman, I'll tell you what, this happened in Las Vegas one time. I was in Las Vegas, it was early in the morning, and there was a pimp slapping a prostitute. And I was with my family, and I stood up and I started to walk over there because I was going to stop it. And my son grabbed me by the shoulders and he goes, "Sit down." He said, "You are not going to get in the middle of this." He said, "I just got security." So even though you want to help sometimes, you can't because you're going to put yourself in danger. And I think, and I've been yelled at before. I've been, you know, just trying to calm things down in a situation that's gotten out of hand. So we have to, I think we need to learn how to calm things down sometimes. And we need to learn how to communicate better. And I think we've lost the ability to actually converse with each other because we use social media too. I keep talking about social media, but we don't have any social skills anymore.
Well, and I think education is really kind of key as well, right? And training. We don't get enough training.
Corporations
who are listening to this, we're talking about DEI in the workplace, advocacy mm-hmm. in the workplace, allyship in the workplace. We need more training on how to de-escalate a situation. That is only going to make everything, you know, a little bit easier, a little bit better, a way for people to actually take action with allyship. Dylan, I'm going to come to you in just a second about the training because you do a lot of that. But Raquita, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight, especially in the case with the woman in the taxi, is that first off is encouraging a culture where marginalized people support one another and empowers the community and amplifies voices is absolutely necessary, but it shouldn't be translated to an obligation or an added burden, especially for marginalized individuals who often themselves face significant burdens and challenges due to their own oppression. Good so expecting point. Her to take on a role of an ally might overlook the emotional, mental, and physical toll of her own experiences of marginalization. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about people having different capacities for engagement. in different capacities to show up. And if you're lacking agency to navigate and feel empowered on, for yourself, it is unlikely that you're going to be able to show up and navigate that on behalf of someone else.
Well, and I thank you for sharing that. And I think the interesting part of that example is the pressure that she put on herself.
Yeah.
Right? Because of what you're talking about. And I think that's another really important point for us and allies to sort of think about is what have we already put on ourselves, you know, before we start talking about what's happened, because a lot of people will put the blame on themselves. They'll be hard enough on themselves. Nobody else needs to be hard on them either. And so when we want to be an ally in a situation like that, we also need to think about, you know, what they've already put themselves through, let alone going through that particular situation with another individual. Dylan, you do a lot of training on this topic, especially within the disability community. Do you hear a lot, you know, people are like, this is too hard for me, I don't know how to do it, you know, and how do you educate them or train them through that?
Well, quite often. And there's a lot of great talking points that have already been said. And I one thing I was going to say earlier is allyship is a journey. It's a journey for anybody at whatever phase you're in. Some people are in the very beginning stages and some people are way in the advanced stages. One individual here on this podcast mentioned about, you know, we could be often seen as an activist or as someone who simply is just an ally. There are allies who can be silent allies. They're doing things behind the scenes, but they not necessarily show it. There are those that are advocates who speak up about certain things. And then there are activists who step right in and resolve the situation right there and head on. I'll give you an experience, Sarah. You know, about a couple months ago, I experienced a locker room talk and how languages in there were used to not necessarily attack, but it was indirectly attacking a segment of the population. And I did not take it. As an activist in me, I will step in and call it out for what it is. But there are times where, you know, when you are in a position of influence or you're in a position where you are representing a large entity, or in this case, I'm the founder of a disability chamber. I represent not only my partners, my members, my stakeholders, my allies, all these people. I have to be fully aware of my surroundings and what I need to do and what I can and cannot do. Let alone if my baby is my project that I've started since I was 5, 7 years ago. But what I will say is this, is the term that my friend would always share with me, and she shares this in the digital accessibility landscape, and that is progress over perfection. Mm-hmm. And I think people often forget that is progress. It takes granular steps to build progress. Some days it's going to be you're doing a really good job, and some days you just have to take a step back. And that is okay because that's still progress. Perfection in allyship, to be honest with you, is not existent. Nothing is perfect. And so I think to the point of all of this, I think the amount of pressure that we put on ourselves and maybe put pressure on others, we have to realize everybody's in a journey. Not everybody... like, for example, in the disability space, the disclosure journey. I mean, not, you know, I would tell you 10, 12 years ago, I would never disclose that I have a disability. Now that I'm part of a safe space, part of a community LinkedIn, well-supported network, I proudly share that I'm deaf and hard of hearing. And so that people know that I'm part of that community, but not everybody is ready to disclose or share mm-hmm. publicly of that journey. And so I think that is important to really think about is we're on this journey personally and professionally or whatever that might be. We need to be mindful. And like you said earlier in the conversation, we got to have grace. We got to have compassion, kindness, and then also really having that intentionality piece.
Can you share with us what happened in that example? What did you do? And what did you say?
I could have done it better.
Okay, that's fair.
I, I will say, and I admit to there's a way to do it, but the way it was targeting LGBTQ youth, and I was in a separate locker, and I heard that, and I said, "Excuse me, what did you say?" And I repeat again, and like he was joking around, and I said, "Look," and I said a bunch of cuss words in that moment, but I could have done it better, but I had to speak up. And I said, that was unacceptable. I mean, we're in 2023, we're already talking about LGBTQ, and let alone disabilities continue to be people still use the R word as well. And so I think there's, in that point of time, it got rocked up and to the point where people started chattering. And because of that chattering, that individual, I kind of put, but then again, I didn't realize, I just was the activist in me in that moment, but the harm that could have potentially, I put a spotlight on somebody that maybe he could have approached it in a different manner instead of putting him on the spotlight. I didn't necessarily decrease the volume. I actually increased the volume as to whether it was impactful or not. But what I will say is that there are a number of people in the locker room, older gentlemen said thank you because they hear that often. And I'm only a young 33-year-old who learned at a young age to speak for myself and advocate for my peers. But I will say is that people are listening, people are observing. No matter how you approach it, just be mindful of what that approach might do and how that might harm that person that's being sort of spoken out against, or also the people in the surroundings that are in that locker room, because locker room talk, there's a lot of, and Weston, you probably have experiences like this. There is going to be talk, but I think there's a moment of time where we have to step in and do something about it. I could have done a better approach, but that approach did elevate the conversation and did call out that was unacceptable.
Can I just acknowledge and say thank you very much for sharing that with us in the authentic way that you did? Because what that demonstrates is that we are all human, experiencing human emotions at any point in time, whether we are confronted with a situation like that or not. And yeah, depending on what your day looked like that day, will have all sorts of effects on how you actually handled that situation. The fact that you shared that with us and walked away with something to change for the next time, and your awareness of being able to do it better the next time, is progress. Yeah. And that is a pure example of what it means to be an ally, and that you aren't going to get it right every single time. And that's why we need the grace and the empathy. And that's why we need conversations like this and examples like this. Because if I go and do that and I don't handle it very well, I'm going to be super hard on myself. But now I'm going to remember your story and be like, wait a second, we all kind of do that. As long as I walk away with a lesson, it will make an impact for next time. And I can do better next time. So I appreciate you for sharing that. All right, so let's talk about how we do better as allies, right? That's a great transition. Thank you so much, Dylan. So how do we do better? How do we be better allies? How do we do that as individuals? We'll start with individuals and then we'll go into organizations and how they can sort of support. Weston, do you want to start?
Sure. And I think beyond what I've already said on different ways to better engage as an ally, I think the biggest thing is, I would say two things. One, sometimes the best way that you can impact things is with the people that you're closest with. There's a lot of ignorance in the world, and there's many instances where people don't even realize they have certain prejudices or certain understandings. And sometimes the best opportunity you have to make a difference in the world is to have real, frank conversations with the people that you are closest with when you see them stepping out of it. They feel like they're in a safe space. They feel like they can say certain things. They may not even realize what it's not willful ignorance, right? Sometimes people say things because they haven't had an experience or they just don't understand. And the first thing I would say is those are the most impactful areas that I feel like you can be an ally, because you're doing it in many instances in a private setting. You're not doing it for some sort of accolade or some sort of recognition. You're doing it with people you genuinely care about, and you just want to see them be better humans, quite frankly. And you know, what I think is so important about that situation is, listen, when people around you, if you walk down the street and you see somebody that is being unhealthy, it's very unlikely you would walk up to a stranger and say, put down the Snickers bar. I think you're, you know, a couple Snickers bars away from diabetes. That's not an appropriate thing to say to somebody. But if a family member of mine, somebody who I love, I see is having that same issue, I'm going to go, you know, mom, don't you think that you should probably change your eating habits because, or, you know, your kids, right? You love them. So you're teaching them out of love because you actually want to see them grow and be healthy, happy, productive human beings. So I feel like that is the same mentality you can take in your inner circles and with people that you do care about. If you can have those types of open conversations, and as long as there's that mutual respect and that mutual love, you should be able to have real dialogue around these situations. And I understand a lot of people put up their walls, but that gets to my second point. And I think where you see situations where somebody's, at least in your impressions, misguided on an issue, they don't understand it, ignorant, engagement is usually the best way, right? When you have, if you're in a setting like the locker room, right? I love that example, because you get into an argument with somebody about something said in a locker room, probably not going to get very far. You're going to actually, in many cases, get them to retreat back into what they've been taught, what they believe in. Whereas if you say, listen, I couldn't disagree with you more. Let's go grab a beer and talk about it. I'd love to understand why you think that way. That's not how I was raised. And I'd love to, if you're open to it, I'd love to share some of the things that I observed in my time in this world, right? And it doesn't always work. No, there's some people that just have their walls up and they for whatever reason, don't want to let their guard down and have that open dialogue. But I would say more often than not, if approached the right way, if you don't do it in a combative setting, but you do it from a place, again, of love and just trying to understand why people feel a certain way and then explain why you maybe disagree with them. Mm-hmm. I think there's a much bigger opportunity to actually incrementally make progress, because a lot of people don't like to be on the defensive. It's just going to make them more defensive. So yeah. I think there's a lot that we can do in smaller settings and closed circles and in a way that comes from again, a place of trying to help understand why people feel certain ways and explain why maybe that's misguided, as yeah. opposed to kind of beat your perspective into them. I think science has shown that that doesn't necessarily work effectively. Right. That's what we can all do yeah. every single day in our circles when we hear something that's wrong. Yeah. And I said earlier, in order to really be an ally, in order to help people, no matter what you're doing, you first have to be in a position to help them. You can't, like, help is something that you have a privilege to be able to help other people in a lot of different instances. No matter what that is. And I feel like far too often, it's more about proving the point than it is about making the difference. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about everybody else here, but I don't see the point in arguing with people about politics or religion at a bar over something, right? Like, but I do see the point in being around people that I care about or in positions where I do have the ability to make that change. I don't need to put myself in a position to get stabbed in a taxi, but what I can do is speak with my friends and family. And when they do something, you know, I had some neighbors say something about a couple that has since moved out of our neighborhood, but same-sex couple, had a bunch of kids, and all of a sudden the comments were about all of the issues were because it was a same-sex couple. And I said, guys, like, first of all, that is completely offensive. Like, you have no reason to talk about that. I was like, but do any of you actually understand what they've gone through? Like, what are your true issues? And when they started talking about, oh, well, their kids leave food in the community pool and stuff, like, that has nothing to do with their sexual orientation. Right. Right, it has right, zero right. to do with that.
Yeah.
You are just creating a narrative. And you know what? I don't know if they've changed their perspectives, but I can tell you they don't talk about these things in front of me anymore.
Right.
So if nothing else, I've told them, I'm not going to put up with that. Like, if you want to have a beer after 5 o'clock in the cul-de-sac with me, you're going to not target people and speak about them in a certain way.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't do that in the local locker room unless I knew people that I was talking to.
Right. And you have to be intentional about your boundaries with the people that you can be intentional about. And I think you make a really good point about the impact that we can make on a smaller scale, but even those small steps eventually make a big impact, because we've been talking about it being progress. And how to make that progress. So I'm going to go to Sharon on the individuals, and then I'm going to go to Raquita and Mickey on how organizations can actually do it. So Sharon, as far as individuals, how do we be better allies?
So I have people reach out to me. Fortunately, I have a pretty wide network these days, having virtual coffees. And sometimes we just need to listen. Mm-hmm. Not so much give advice, but just know that they have someone they can talk to and talk. They don't really want your help. They just want somebody to talk it through with sometimes. The other thing is I reach out to the young people these days, because I think that's where a lot of this starts, and we need to stop it at the youth level. And so I have granddaughters that are in high school, and it's amazing how much they talk to me as an older person. I'm really pretty surprised, but they talk about, you know, all the subjects that we're dealing with in corporate America now and online. And so when you have an opportunity to get at their level and just talk one-on-one sometimes, that's the beginning of the long journey, mm-hmm. you know, to change things. And so Dylan is right. It is a journey. It doesn't happen overnight. And I hope that I live long enough to see the change for the better. It has gotten better, I will say. Some of the people that are younger don't see it yet. But when you've seen as much as I have, you know it is getting better. And so, yeah, I just, you know, you reach out to people if they're having a problem, just say, hey, if you need to talk, I'm here. And then 9 times out of 10, they will talk to you. You just have to be open to talk to them.
Well, and open that door too. I love mm-hmm. that. Thank you so much, Sharon. Mickey, what can organizations do to foster a culture of allyship? What do you think?
I mean, definitely be aware. We do have a change squad. We called them the Culture Club at first, but change that. So I think it's really about, and I like what Weston said, right? I call it something different. I say in leadership, you want to always call a person in, meaning speak to them from a place of love and or a place of wisdom, and give them advice about what the bad behaviors are, instead of calling a person out. So you call a person in versus out. Changing a culture, or changing a company culture is very difficult, because there's a lot of personalities and who says who is right and who is wrong. So really it's about yourself as a leader coming from a place of understanding that you're listening to what the right, you know, what people want, and that you're acknowledging all groups, not necessarily just the group you prefer, giving voices to your people, and just always being present. To me, allyship needs to be a verb and not a noun. You need to be doing it every day. You need to be listening every day. You know, sometimes that's easier when you have 5 grandchildren and they're all different and they all want to eat something different. And how do you please all of them? And how do you cook, you know, 10 things at one time? But you do it because there is a basic joy. Love that. So you need to apply that in the corporate field as well. You need to care about your people. And when you care about your people and do those right things, they're going to see it. And, you know, it's a pay it forward kind of thing. So it's very difficult. It doesn't happen overnight. And I don't think it's ever ending. And here we have our unique culture, right? Unity, nurturing, understanding, you know, all of that, and we're constantly, constantly putting that into people's brain. I don't think it'll ever be perfect, but we also have to accept that, you know, some people won't go there, and that's okay. That's that person. So it's a lot of work and a lot of resources. I think before you used to be able to give out cozies and, you know, people say to me, oh, let's get a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's not what we're about. You know, we're about contributing, giving to the community, et cetera. So yeah, the t-shirt was a, you know, you spent your money and it was done and you did a good job for the company. Here we focus more on, you know, doing for the community and really changing. And that is not, you know, you can't put a KPI on that. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult and it can be very exhausting and very frustrating.
Yeah.
But one day at a time, I want to say.
One day at a time. Doesn't that sum that up so well? Thank you so much, Mickey. Raquita, what do you think? What can organizations do to cultivate allyship and make people feel safe?
Yeah, so I talk about this a little bit in my TED Talk. I gave a TED Talk a couple of years ago about what was that real pivot for me. And when I started my career, my only concern was, you know, building wealth and generating wealth and growing and having more leadership responsibility to take care of my family. And it wasn't until I started getting involved in community organizations and really spending time in community engagement and social justice initiatives that I could see how my skills, talents align with the greater good. And in that alignment, I became really invested in building inclusive culture, not only in my community, but I brought that mindset back into my organization. And I think for me, that was also a significant time where I pivoted from the behavior of an individual contributor to what it actually means to lead. So I think a lot of organizations do have the opportunity to encourage and support employee involvement in community organizations. People need to know their skills, unique talents are aligned with the greater good. And sometimes they can't see that in their core responsibilities in the day-to-day achievement of business results. They need to know that there are collaborative projects. They need to know that there are opportunities for them to strive for more leadership opportunities. And I think community engagement can help us achieve that. The other part is to ensure that there is representation in leadership and in the decision-making bodies within the organization. Even as you are trying to diversify your executive leadership team.
Yeah. Yeah. Representation really does matter. You know, it's one of the reasons why we did the Blended Pledge, because we want to see representation, because we want folks to see what is possible and where they can go. And we also want allies to see what that means. Right.
Yeah.
Dylan, one more thing before I ask the last question. Do you have any resources where people can go to maybe learn a little bit more about allyship?
Good question. I don't know of sources. Maybe other people on this call that might do. Mm-hmm. But what I would reference point is if you align with a specific community or organization, like my organization, Disability Chamber, I always say, go to them. They're their experts in their field based on that. And part of that is, if you want to get more exposure, I say, you know, allyship is learning. It's a learning process. And so I encourage everyone who are listening in to really go to the communities that you want to build a connection with, or you want to learn more simply. And those charitable organizations, they're there to support you. They're there to provide educational opportunities. Volunteer engagement opportunities. I mean, there's just a number of avenues. I cannot necessarily pick one source, but mm-hmm. what I would say is that the ones that in your communities, respective communities, you know, Weston mentioned the Cambodian organization. I mean, just go to them where they, and I always say, meet them where they are. And I think that's a good way of learning and building your allyship journey.
Well, and what about going there and just asking the question, how can I be a good ally? What do you need from me? Raquita?
Yeah, I'd like to recommend a couple resources that have definitely been helpful for me over the years. So the first thing that I think that everyone should do is use Harvard University's Project Implicit. It offers implicit association tests and helps individuals to identify and understand their own implicit biases. So I think that, you know, that's a really good start. And one of the other toolkits that have been helpful for me along the way is Coursera has a number of really good diversity, equity, and inclusion workplace courses. as well as the Equity Toolkit. And it provides resources and tools for organizations and individuals to deepen their understanding and the practice of equity and what that looks like in your organization.
Awesome. And what's the title of your TED Talk?
How Determination Changed My Life.
All right. So go and check out that TED Talk. All right. So we are now down to the last question. You don't have a lot of time to think about this, and you don't have a lot of time to explain it. So what is one thing that you would like the audience to walk away from this discussion, either thinking about or taking action on? Because we want to make sure that people are leaving these conversations and, you know, making an impact, whether it's small, big, medium, whatever that looks like to that individual. Sharon, I'm going to start with you. What's one thing?
Okay. I think it's we all have unique personalities. We have unique backgrounds. We all have issues that nobody knows about that we can actually understand other people's problems. And so reach out to everybody on this panel today, because we all have a way to help you in some way or another. So use the people that you meet and reach out. Don't be afraid.
Love that. Take some action. Dylan, what's one thing you want people walking away from this with?
Progress over perfection. I can't stress that enough. You know, allyship is a journey. And as long as you put your mind and your heart and your soul into this process, no matter what journey you're on, just think of it as progress.
Love that. Mickey.
I'm going to go old school. I always think of allyship as apostleship. And you need apostles in your life. You need people that will tell the story of you, and you need to tell the story of others. So always think about, when you're helping people, it's really a part of leaving legacy and being a part of other people's legacy. So yeah, utilize allyship as much as you can, and also be an ally.
Love that. Weston.
Yeah, I think like three quick points. One is, and I'll keep saying this, intent matters, right? Second is you can lead from anywhere, and you don't need to have a title or be, you don't have to be given the permission to be a leader. There's opportunities to lead every day. And just by living, my third point, live your most authentic life and be open-minded. And you can be a leader just in the way that you engage situations and how you interact with people on a daily basis. I think love breeds love, right? And hate breeds hate. And so if you approach things in the right way and you do it with the right intent, you can actually make a bigger difference in the world incrementally than you can from the top of a mountain with a microphone.
Amazing. Amazing. And last but not least, you get the last word here, Raquita.
Do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. That's a quote by Maya Angelou that I absolutely love. And it really embodies the importance of allies holding ourselves and others accountable and being open to feedback as we aim to continue to be a support to one another. Acknowledge your mistakes, learn from them, make amends, and foster an environment of value where you value and uplift everyone.
Great, great. I love that quote. So in today's world, one of pursuing equity and understanding the power of diversity, many people want to get involved and be part of driving change. And although many may perceive themselves as allies, the reality can be different. Because allyship is more than just posting on social media or other acts of tokenism. It's tough. It demands consistency, time, and dedication, and comes with sacrifice and cost. Allyship has been described not as a badge, but as a battle scar. And if we want to be better allies, we all need to embrace the fight. Remember that you can reach out to me or any of the guests on social media if you have anything you'd like to add to what we've talked about today. And remember to join us next month when we'll be talking about networking etiquette. That's right. I go to a lot of events and they always leave me with plenty to think about, from what you wear to what you drink, even whether or not you give a handshake in a post-pandemic world. There's a lot of different factors at play. So we're going to be diving into all of that next month, sharing everything you need to know ahead of the upcoming event season. So thank you so much to Raquita, Mickey, Sharon, Weston, and Dylan for joining me today and being brave and sharing so authentically. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.